Make your morning commute 50 times more exciting with Girl Riot. Tune in to get your share of female musicians and vocalists, interviews with local bands, and girl gossip. Catch us on Wednesday mornings from 7 to 9 a.m. on the air at 103.3 FM or online at valleyfreeradio.org.
This is novelist Tom Robbins. When my mother was diagnosed with glaucoma, her conservative Virginia physician told her there was only one treatment that might ease her pain and save her eyesight. That treatment was medical marijuana, which he could not prescribe. I offered to get her some and teach her how to use it effectively, but my father objected because marijuana was against the law. So my mother, who loved to read and walk in nature, was condemned to grow cruelly, unnecessarily blind. Tragedies like this happen all the time, but they don't have to keep happening. To learn more about medical marijuana, call the Marijuana Policy Project at 1-877-JOIN-MPP or visit them on the web at mpp.org.
You say, I got to love my neighbor. Well, not really. Who would you say my neighbor is?
Who are my neighbors? Tune in to Out There to meet some of them. Out There airs every Wednesday from 4 to 5 in the afternoon with me, Ruthie Woodring. Come with me and my recorder to meet people and plants and think about ways we can share the world. That's Out There every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. here on Valley Free Radio. Get out if you can. But if you can't get out, tune in. And that's today. Thanks for tuning in.
This edition of Out There originally aired on January 6th, 2016. Most of today's show is an interview with Ezra Parzabach.
Ezra is a medical marijuana consultant whose home was recently raided, but he wasn't charged with a crime, and also an outspoken proponent of medical marijuana. Also today, I've got a little piece from Luna Puchelski, a friend and neighbor who took a recorder out in the street of Northampton to ask people about challenges that this country faces in the upcoming year. I got about 5 minutes of that. And so I'm just going to go ahead and play Luna's stuff. Luna was actually on my show as a live guest in November. I wanted to say sometime around the 12th of November. It's on the archives of Out There, which are online at weatherbeard.com/out there. Singer-songwriter Luna Puchelski. She's 12 years old and a seventh grader at Pioneer Valley Performing Arts Academy, school, whatever. So here's Luna. The recorder sound quality may be a little bit difficult to hear, but bear with us. Next time, it'll be better, I bet.
This is Luna Puchelski, and I will be out here for a segment on Valley Free Radio asking people questions. Excuse me? I was wondering if you two would have some time to answer a question for a segment on Valley Free Radio. Yeah, I know, I'm kind of young. In this coming year, what do you think are some of the most important issues for us to face for our country?
That's a really big question. I just want to pass my classes.
I mean, true, college. I think people really have to be mindful of going the next year about community and not just themselves, especially when it comes to, like, political decisions and just, like, just how they treat their community, because a lot of people go forward in making decisions based on themselves, and I think a lot of people just have to make the right decision based not only on themselves, but, like, for everyone involved.
Yeah. I think as a country we have to be mindful, I mean, specifically not to listen to Donald Trump, but also just understand that what he's saying and what many candidates are saying is not just harmful, and that the fact that it's not just that what they're doing is fear-mongering and getting them votes, but it also reflects on the country as a whole towards the rest of the world and makes us seem like I mean, I'm not saying we're perfect, but makes us seem a lot worse than we are, and is going to give people a horrible idea, and often feeds extremist groups in a way that they shouldn't be doing. They're not helping anyone.
Sure, not a problem.
So, as we're coming into this new year, I was wondering what you thought the biggest problem that our country has to face is.
The deficit. The deficit is the big thing. We got to wipe it out, and Donald Trump is right. We got to stop people from coming here because we can't afford to feed them all. And the more money it takes to feed all these people, the more it takes out of everybody's pocket that's working. And there's not enough jobs. There's just not enough jobs, so we got to stop the people from coming here. It's some kind of sad, but that's the way it is. Time to tear down the Statue of Liberty and tell it like it really is. Enough's enough. No other countries will take these people because they don't want them, because they don't want their problems. And I think Donald Trump is right, and he's got my vote all the way.
Thank you for your opinion.
You're welcome.
In the national level, politically, I believe the most important issue for me will be fighting terrorism and controlling our borders. I believe that we should deploy more of our armed forces out overseas and find a solution to control the borders around our nation. Whether that means hiring more personnel to do that, so be it. We really have an issue that we need to address in terrorism, and we have to fight it. I'm a true believer that we got to live free, and we got people in the armed forces that are securing our liberty. So.
In the next year, what do you think are some of the most important problems that we need to face for our country?
Next year. That's short term, isn't it? Short term. Let's say direct action towards climate change. Recycling programs in rural communities. I'm speaking like further into the depths of the state where people throw everything in the one trash receptacle because there's nowhere else to put it besides just flinging it out over their shoulder. Woods.
The less educated, less affluent neighborhoods, that's where you really need to reach.
Yeah. Where people are thinking about how do they heat their house, how do they feed their kids, how do they pay their rent.
Yeah.
And they're not going to pay extra to get rid of their plastic bottles when they can just rip them in the trash. Well, it could be where our taxes go. Taxes, they get taken from us. Where do they go? I have no idea. So if I had my way, I would be able to elect where my taxes go.
So recycling is one. But I think it really starts with what we're buying the stuff in. So it's more of solving an issue from a defeated standpoint, which is recycling, versus if it started from, you know, the movement back toward glass, less plastic, you know, consumables. That's right. Because the plastic, not much of it really gets recycled anyway. Most of it ends up blowing out in the ocean, where it then photodegrades, fish eat it, and we take it back in another form.
Yeah.
So that was Luna Puchowski taking the recorder to downtown Northampton. Thanks, Luna, for doing that on the street interview. Ezra, if you have anything to add, you can go ahead.
That was a great piece. I applaud Luna. And it's great to hear such a wide spectrum of diversity of opinion right downtown Northampton.
Yeah. And then I have one more thing before we go into the interview with Ezra.
If you go inside the Smith College Campus Center at 100 Elm Street, inside the door, the double doors, you'll find a couple of bulletin boards. They're mostly empty because school's between session. But one of the flyers on the bulletin boards is a flyer printed by the Center for Religious and Spiritual Life in the Office of Inclusion, Diversity, and Equity. And it's entitled, How You Can Stop Islamophobia. I'm going to read that flyer. How can you be a source of support for a friend, peer, or colleague who is Muslim? Here are four ways to make a difference. 1. Learn more about Islam and its followers. Take a class. Read a book. Observe a typical Friday prayer service. Engage in conversation with your Muslim friend about her faith how she practices it, and how it influences her outlook on life. Above all, listen with an open mind, because we all have biases. 2. Pay attention to the way long-standing stereotypes about Muslims as unpatriotic, backward, dangerous, and violent saturate the media and society at large. Notice how certain politicians, pundits, and even academics explicitly and subtly demonize entire groups of people. Feel empowered to speak out against racism and intolerance when you see it. 3. Walk or ride the bus with a peer or a colleague who is Muslim, especially at night. With incidents of Islamophobic hate speech and crimes on the rise, Muslim students may feel uncomfortable or unsafe in certain public situations. Be willing to stand with your fellow students. 4. Show you care. Expressing concern for the well-being of Muslims is part of showing solidarity with them. Displays of kindness, such as bringing a friend tea or chocolate, could go a long way and are at the heart of Islam. If you or your friends need assistance, contact Jennifer Walters, jwalters@smith.edu, or Dwight Hamilton, dhamilton@smith.edu. Brought to you by the Center for Religious and Spiritual Life and the Office of Inclusion, Diversity, and Equity. There's one more thing on the flyer that's scrawled on the top, but I'm not going to read it because it's hate language against Muslims. It's also been scribbled out.
So you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ LP Northampton, 103.3 FM, and streaming online at valleyfreeradio.org. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring.
The rest of today's show is an interview with Ezra Parzabak,
medical marijuana consultant and also a neighbor, and whose home was recently raided. He's going to talk a little bit about that and many other questions I have for him. Ezra, thanks again for coming in today.
Sure, happy to.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well, getting over a 2015 cold, but I'm doing great.
Great. I wonder if you could just maybe talk a little bit about yourself. Like, how did you become involved in and knowledgeable about medical marijuana?
Well, I came to cannabis late. I think I was a typical high school student in that I tried it a few times at parties and tried it a few times in college, but was never really that interested in it until I was in my 30s, owned my own home, had kids, and had a lot more stress in my life. And I remember being at someone's house and something was passed to me and I inhaled and I felt this incredible relaxation that I had not felt before with cannabis. And being an educator and someone who taught in Holyoke with disadvantaged youth and was surrounded by conversation about cannabis and pot and weed for years, I wanted to connect the dots in terms of researching, is it scientific? Is there some sort of medical benefit to cannabis? And then I realized, so I did quit my teaching job, and I just realized that there was a huge gap in information between what I call sort of the pothead culture, the culture of recreational cannabis, which I think is fine. There's a full spectrum of culture. And the other side is bona fide, legitimate medical uses that I did research on and found existed. And then I started to advise, and I put out a shingle essentially saying, look, I'm a professional. I have objective information. I was growing my own cannabis at that point as a patient. I could grow my own. So I went and got my card and I was growing it and developing concoctions and studying the plant and how it worked. And then teaching others how to grow, how to diagnose their symptoms, how to make recipes. And over and over and over again, I was blown away by what helped people. The people who were most sick, that had the most number of surgeries, the most number of conventional therapies that they tried that no longer worked for them. And cannabis filled a gap.
What are some of the things you mentioned like surgeries or recover from that. What are some of the things that people use medical marijuana for, and how is it more advantageous than other medications that they could get from a pharmacist?
Well, a good way to look at it is when we think of pain medication, we don't have one type. There's not only Advil or only morphine. There are tons of different Percocet, morphine, oxycodone, oxycontin, methadone, all these different drugs. Many people try many different things. And if you have a chronic pain illness, so I would consult with patients, say, who had been struck by a car. So they had multiple broken bones, multiple fused discs, and huge amounts of chronic pain that is unbelievably severe. And when you're ingesting huge amounts of opiates into your system, you become imbalanced. You have side effects that you don't like, or you have this fogginess that separates you from the reality you want to be in. So those people, when they try cannabis, the body is just so welcoming to this completely new drug, essentially. And you can take it in doses that are very tiny to start with. You know, I would advise patients, stick with the medication you have. Try a very small amount, microdosing, I call it, where you don't have to get high. You just are ingesting small amounts of the cannabinoids. Scientifically, the way it works in the cells is it regulates the behavior. So if you can reduce the amount of pain you have, then you can start taking away, maybe you can reduce a fentanyl patch by a certain amount. And then the insomnia that you got because of that opiate, you don't have to take as much of the sleep aid. And then you don't have to take the drug that helps you with your constipation that you get from the sleep aid. There's a slippery slope.
So, like, are there side effects of medical marijuana?
There's a huge debate about that. And I like to be as objective as possible. The more I work with patients, the more I realize that it can be quite harmful, that it is a very powerful drug. And the side effects, when you compare it to something like opiates, the worst side effect of an opiate is fatality. So the worst side effect of cannabis is addiction, I would say. But you can't die from it. So comparing them side by side, if you have to take a huge amount of opiates, but you can relieve the amount of opiates you take by just taking some cannabis, something that you know is not going to kill you, that's a huge benefit. But a lot of people do not like the high. If you're someone who, an adult who is used to being sober your whole life, and maybe aside from these opiates you're taking, or that you're not on any drugs at all, you just want to try something natural, getting stoned or getting high can be incredibly uncomfortable and non-desirable. So that is a side effect that many people enjoy and a side effect that many people dislike. Also, I think the addiction is very subtle with cannabis. People who take huge amounts, and I know people who are taking huge amounts of cannabis for their pain. So they're medical patients, but they're smoking 10, 15, 20 joints a day. And there is a point at which you feel like your status in life is enough, because cannabis just kind of keeps you with a B average or a C average, and you don't feel that need to exercise as much as you would normally, to eat as healthy food, because, well, the cannabis just kind of makes you feel good and takes the edge off the pain. But it's the same addiction side effect as you'd have with other pharmaceuticals. So essentially the side effect is of cannabis, I think, is how we worry about any vice, in that if you take too much of it, if you abuse it, that's the worst way to approach it.
So you had been doing this for a number of years, you know, doing research and consulting, and then, like, what are the rules, regulations around growing your own as a patient, or how did...
So when we passed the law in 2013, November of 2012, so we're going on the fourth year, the regulation stated that if you have a card, if you get a medical marijuana card, you are allowed to grow your own personal supply of marijuana. There were no numbers associated with that. There wasn't a certain number of plants. The idea was you can have a two-month supply. Uh-huh. So currently, and this the regulation said, you're sort of grandfathered in as being able to provide your own medicine because there is no legitimate way to provide it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was before the dispensary.
That's right.
And stuff,
yeah. Once the dispensary opens within 30 miles of your home, then you should be able to go to the dispensary and get it. Uh-huh. Now there
30
is
30 miles is kind of a long ways.
It's a long ways. If you're in a wheelchair, and have to ride the bus, that's a huge deal. The regulation tried to accommodate for that by saying, okay, dispensaries should have a way to get it to people. Mm-hmm. Caregivers can buy it at the dispensary and then deliver it. If you can register to be someone's specific caregiver. It's complicated, especially. And I asked a DA on a panel I was on, saying, well, when the dispensaries finally do open, after perhaps thousands of people have learned how to grow their own medicine, are they really going to want to drop it all and have to go buy it much more expensive at the dispensary?
Right.
He said, well, it's sort of a case-by-case basis. We'll see what happens. But to me, it's disappointing that the regulation created essentially criminals, especially since it took so long for dispensaries to open. So people may have been growing their own medicine for a couple of years. It's actually quite therapeutic to grow and to garden and to grow medicine that makes you feel better. So right now, it is actually still technically legal to grow a certain amount of marijuana. And I won't go into the details, but essentially you can't buy enough at the dispensary to supply you for a 2 month. You can buy, I believe, 4 ounces every 2 months at the dispensary, but the law allows for 10 ounces. Mm-hmm. So you can make up the difference by growing 6 ounces. Mm-hmm. So people do still grow. I was raided. I don't grow anymore. I am tired of being in a gray area legally. And I do feel that my role now in the community is as an educator, getting the word out and actually trying to educate people to understand that cannabis should be more medical, that we should have a more in-depth discussion and more data about how to use it medically before we jump into recreation, where it's kind of anybody's guess how that's going to be regulated and used, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about, like, when and why you were raided and what that whole thing was like?
Sure. Essentially, it did cause a lot of rumors and drama in the community because I am an outspoken proponent of medical cannabis. I'd been in the paper and on the radio many times talking about essentially my conservative approach to cannabis. But I was growing cannabis outside and in the black market, in the underground world, that's a big no-no. They all know about the helicopters that fly over and search for cannabis. And I still did it. I guess I didn't believe that I would get caught in my little suburban neighborhood with a National Guard helicopter spying my plants. But they do these runs. They do these grid patterns over Western Mass, and there's a certain budget in the DEA federal budget to eradicate this Schedule I dangerous drug. And as my lawyer mentioned, they do have their year-end fiscal budget and they kind of send their guys out. And this is sort of a tangent, but they do have a sweet deal in that they can see plants from the air. They can call in the ground troops. They go cut the plants down. By the end of the year, they have 1,000 plants or whatever. None of the citizens are going to complain because no one wants to call the cops and say, hey, someone stole my marijuana plants, even though they are going onto property without a search warrant and cutting down plants. But it looks really good for the DEA because they're eradicating plants and the citizens are quite silent about it. So I think there is part of me, and I haven't said this publicly, but I went to art school. I love to live on the cutting edge. And I think it's a fascinating discussion to talk about that issue and what we're going to do about a plant, a drug that can grow accidentally in your yard if you drop a seed. So I was raided. When it happened, they came to my home. They were the most polite and cordial and downright apologetic policemen I have ever met. You know, they said, look, this is, we're just doing our job. What you're doing will be legal in a year or two. It's the lawmaker's fault. I heard that a lot. But they did have to do their job and cut down the plants. And when they did get into my home, they found all my medical remedies. And there was sufficient evidence to charge me with distribution. And as I have come clean publicly in the local media, I was distributing. In fact, the day of the raid, I was delivering a topical oil to an 84-year-old patient. So they got me.
So how did the raid and all the publicity around it, how has that affected your family or you and your family?
It's a great question. It's been really difficult. I do feel grateful that I had an amazing legal team. I feel grateful that I was very conservative in my approach to cannabis and was able to submit pages and pages of patient testimony for my case. But it was my livelihood. I was known as the go-to guy on both professionalism, education, patient advice, and medical cannabis. So I was distributing it to patients. And now I don't have my business, and it has been an identity crisis for me and difficult for my family. You know, it's made me empathic with the millions of other people who lose their jobs or their restaurants burn down or whatever it is. It's also hard to be a well-educated professional doing good in the community, supported by my community, but also have a certain, there's a certain connotation as being a drug dealer. Mm-hmm. And I do want to change the stereotype around that. I spent a lot of time with people of color in the inner city and realized how imbalanced our justice system is. Mm-hmm. I was told by a lawyer, if I had brown skin and I lived in Springfield or Holyoke, my mm-hmm. kids would have been taken out of my home within 24 hours, which is probably true. And I do hope that my case can help change the dialogue about other people mm-hmm. who are disadvantaged and perhaps how they use cannabis, where they're getting their cannabis, how it might or might not be safe for children. These are also discussions we're going to have. Cannabis is already in the homes of over 10,000 medical marijuana patients in the state, and many of them have children. So although it's affected me in a negative way, it was very difficult. It's been a financial challenge. I do feel committed to helping the community have this conversation in an intelligent way. We do need to talk about what to do with cannabis and kids. And so few people are talking about it. Medical professionals don't really understand it. The underground pothead culture doesn't really talk about it either. They just want it legalized. And I still feel I'm in this middle ground of saying, let's have a good discussion about it. Let's not dismiss it as a dangerous drug, but also there are some issues. There is some harm. Eating gummy bears filled with cannabis is not something I would want my children to do.
Yeah. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Ezra Parzivak, medical marijuana consultant. This is out there on Valley Free Radio, 103.3 FM, WXOJ, Northampton. Ezra, I wanted to ask you, kind of continuing that conversation. So do you think if pot were, or marijuana were legalized for recreational use as well, do you think the numbers of people using it, like, do you think there'd be like a spike and then it would like settle down to like a, I don't know if there's like a percentage of society that's likely to use it one way or the other, whether it's legal or illegal, if you have any thoughts on that?
It's a great question. It's difficult to tell. I think communities are very different. So what happened in Colorado is going to be different from what will happen in Massachusetts when inevitably we legalize it recreationally. I believe the data in Colorado is that there has been a spike. There are more users, but there have been positive changes that have occurred, such as fewer fatalities. I think a lot of people are trying cannabis to replace alcohol in many ways. There are people who are sick of getting drunk at the bar, and they try cannabis for the first time, and they realize, wow, I can really take the edge off or recreate or medicate with this, and I don't get a hangover. My skin doesn't dry out. I don't make poor choices and drive dangerously. So there will be a spike. The question is, will the community suffer? I personally believe that the net benefit to society when cannabis is legalized, or that there will be a net benefit. I think there will be fewer opiate overdoses because people know they can supplement. There will be fewer alcohol-related crimes and dangers associated with it. A great way to look at it is bars, for example. Imagine if in your neighborhood they opened a bar. Do you think there'd be a spike in drunk driving, a spike in domestic violence, a spike in all the things, alcoholism, that we associate with a bar or with drinking? And typically when a bar opens up in a neighborhood, it's kind of quiet. And alcohol is much more dangerous than cannabis. Mm-hmm. So when cannabis is legalized, I think people will find it's quite quiet. Mm-hmm. It's a quiet drug. People who smoke cannabis tend to do it privately. They're not loud, boisterous, and violent. And this is shown in the data.
Great. So someone had a question they wanted me to ask you. This person lives in federal public housing and has the medical marijuana card and is wondering if, because of federal drug laws, if they potentially face eviction.
That is a great question. That is not an uncommon question. I recommend going on to Evans Cutler website, evanscutler.com, Mike Cutler and Dick Evans, or even just calling these guys up. They are in town. They were my lawyers for my case, and they're very knowledgeable. So if you have legal questions, go to them. I will say that if you have a medical marijuana card, in general, you are protected from many of the issues, legal issues, because it shows you've gone through the proper channels to acquire your medical marijuana. So that's a benefit. I will say, though, that if you're in public housing, you are of a low socioeconomic status, or you are a person of color, statistically speaking, the chances of you being arrested or brought to charges for marijuana are greater than if you are of a higher socioeconomic status, living in your own home and are middle class and white. So I personally would not mess with having marijuana while you're in public housing. That's a federally funded property. Federal law states that all marijuana is illegal. So I don't recommend it personally, having it, but it's very common.
Yeah, and I mean, if you have a health condition that's really painful and chronic and you really need it to alleviate some of your pain, that's the best way you can find it. It seems like a really hard position to be in.
I agree. And if so, the worst case scenario is the police come to your public housing unit and they have a warrant or probable cause to search your home and they discover it. So getting to that point is quite difficult unless you're under investigation or you're doing something egregious. So when they get there, if and when, hopefully they don't, but if they do, I always recommend that patients be very honest about their ailment, be very polite to the police, maybe have a letter from their doctor specifically stating why they're using it. And if you're using it medicinally, then I don't think there should be a problem. And I think that police officers are rational enough to know the difference between someone who's just a drug dealer abusing it and someone who has a little bit of cannabis legally and they have a card. So that gives you the whole spectrum of where to gauge your own risk.
All right. You've been listening to an interview with Ezra Parzivak on Valley Free Radio. I'm going to play this here.
Can't make bail? Stay in jail. I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. When a person is accused of a crime, a judge can release him on his or her own recognizance, that is, without cash bail, or the judge can set bail. The purpose of bail is to reasonably assure the defendant's appearance in court. Bail functions as a stick and a carrot. If you go to court when you're told to, you get the money back, and if you don't show up, you lose the cash. But many poor people can't make bail of $50 or $100 or $1,000 or $2,000. Bail might as well be $200,000. So poor defendants are way more likely to languish in jail awaiting their court dates, which puts enormous pressure on them to plead guilty and be sentenced to time served, even if you're totally innocent. Consider how bizarre this bail system is. You can insist on your innocence, which means languishing in jail, held on bail, or you can forfeit all your rights and plead guilty and be released and regain your freedom that day or soon thereafter. A person held on bail is 6 times more likely to be sentenced to jail than a person who was released pre-trial. And it costs about $55,000 a year to detain a person who hasn't made bail. Those persons could be released on their own recognizance with conditions such as curfews, drug tests, reporting requirements, treatment, therapy, stay-away orders, and the like. But many, too many, aren't. The Eighth Amendment prohibits excessive bail, but the Eighth Amendment remains an unfulfilled promise. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
So back to Ezra Parzivak. Ezra, I wonder if you could talk about any of the patients you had and what the situations are like for some of them.
Well, there were amazing stories and incredible success stories that I've had that shocked me as well as the patient. A lot of people who are just at their wit's end in terms of conventional medicine, they try cannabis in the appropriate dose and the appropriate administration method, and they just get a lot of relief from it. And I think that tells a great story right there. One amazing specific story was a patient who came to me who had been fighting stage 4 cancer for years and lived longer than the doctors had projected. But when he came to me, his last doctor visit, the doctor said, look, it's at this point, it's a matter of time. The cancer had metastasized into his lungs. He was in a lot of pain. He had trouble breathing. And so I was very conservative in treating him. And I said, look, let's start with just an oil. You can take a little bit before bed. Maybe it'll help you sleep. And eventually he tried that and we worked together for a few months. And I did a lot of research on cannabis, inhaling smoke, and cancer. And I had a hunch that since he was at stage 4, since he was given essentially no more than a couple months to live, and there has not been a single case of cancer connected to smoking pot. Cannabis is a proven analgesic, so it does relieve pain. It also dilates the bronchial tubes. So I thought, what if I could get this patient to take a microdose, a tiny puff of cannabis into his lungs and see if it helped his pain, helped his breathing, and just gave him some general relief. So at first we started with vaporizing. And vaporizing is the common alternative because you don't inhale smoke. Mm-hmm. Well, one, he hated his vaporizer. Mm-hmm. They're cumbersome and have many parts. And some people just, you know, he was about 65. He was sort of not tech savvy guy. Mm-hmm. And
it's like this electronic device. Right?
I know. What? For smoking? How does it work? And I also have found with vaporizers that you have to inhale with a little more force. So if your lungs are in pain and you have trouble breathing, it's like breathing through a pillow. It's even more difficult. Whereas the appropriate type of pipe allows you to just take a very quick, rapid breath. So I didn't force him to do it. I knew that he had to come to it himself, this idea of literally smoking something for his lungs that had stage 4 lung cancer. It was a crazy idea. Yeah. And I think not having a medical background made me think so far outside the box in that regard. I have an art background, so I was like, okay, let's totally take this from a different angle. Well, it was fascinating because I convinced him to try it. I said, take one puff a day. That's a very, very small amount. I gave him a strain that was known for not having high THC, so he didn't want to get high. He wasn't interested in that. And also had something called CBD, cannabidiol, which is a molecule in cannabis that is shown to reduce tumors. So there is some evidence that cannabis in a lab has shown some moderate benefits towards cancer. So after about 2 or 3 months, I called him to check in. I mean, I was checking in on him, but I didn't even know if he was alive because he did not have much time. So I just wanted to see how he was doing. Well, after 2 or 3 months, when I called him, he said, you know, I'll tell you what, I've been doing one puff a day. My lungs are feeling so much better. I can breathe better and the pain is gone. So I thought, great. You know, I'm a scientifically minded person. I'm not saying that that would work for everyone, but that's a fascinating success with a drug that you would never think that it would have any positive benefit, let alone provide relief.
How is that possible?
The story does not end there. It's fascinating. So he kept using it. And over the months, a few more months later, he was also trying, you know, some oil. He would put oil on his parts of his body. I mean, he really was riddled with cancer. So he would rub oil onto his body as well. It can have analgesic effects for the body and soften the tissues and whatnot. Well, about 6 to 8 months after he came to me, he went to his pulmonologist, his oncologist, and they did a CAT scan on his lungs, and the cancer was completely gone. So coming to me, having like 3 months before, he was given a few months to live. He came to me for cannabis, for relief, for symptom relief, you know, sort of the hospice, end of life, a little bit more quality of life. I tried something radical with him and it gave him symptom relief. And I won't say that I cured his cancer. It's too difficult to know scientifically whether that's the case or not. But he believes that his cancer, he caught it early enough. So he had cancer, prostate cancer. It had gone into his bones, but when it went into his lungs and started giving him that discomfort, he tried cannabis right away on that. And here it was, 3, 6, 7 months later, that he was getting symptom relief and then complete eradication of the cancer. And so I talked to him recently. It's been almost 2 years, and he still has cancer in his body, but his lung cancer has never returned. So he really associates his relationship with that. You know, he did no more than 3 puffs, he would tell me. And I would joke, I assume, on a Friday night. Right? So that is a story, to me, that at the very least warrants more study. Right? There is something in science called an X equals 1 or N equals 1 trial, where you test a drug on just one subject. And if you have some sort of benefit, then it is proof that it should be conducted on a larger scale. I do think that there's more to it than just giving people cannabis in the medical model. I do think you need a compassionate caregiver.
Yeah.
You need someone who can make a patient feel truly comfortable in how they're utilizing a drug. You know, you wouldn't just say, yeah, go to the dispensary and smoke some pot. I mean, how many people are actually going to feel comfortable doing that? So there are a lot of other elements at play, but it's a fascinating story.
So with the the raid and your probation and like are you still consulting or like what happened to your patients?
Yep.
How does that feel?
It feels great when I can consult. I'm reaching out to a lot of the dispensaries right now and going to reach out to dispensaries in Connecticut because I really want to help shape their medical approach to cannabis. They're hiring a lot of Colorado teams and teams who are just sort of know how to grow and dispense it. And that's fine. But I do think that there is an approach that you can offer to patients that is really beneficial. So I do feel I have that knowledge. I've talked with some teams and they're interested, but a lot of them are sort of waiting to get their approval to open up. And then they'll have me come in and help them design their operation. So what I am doing is working with patients right now. So a lot of people will call me and just say, look, I go to the dispensary or I already get it from my friend. I just don't know how to use it or I don't know how to do the microdosing or I don't know how to get my card. So by all means, anything that I can do that's First Amendment protected, education and getting the word out and speaking to people, I can do. I love to do lectures. I love to do radio shows. I love to speak at senior centers and I spoke at the Rotary Club. So if anyone out there is interested in bringing what I feel is a rational, objective voice in a very smoky field of confusion, that's what I do.
And is there a website where people can contact you or find more information?
Uh-huh. You can. I always tell people the easiest way to find me is to Google Ezra Cannabis Consultant, E-Z-R-A, or my name, EzraParzibach.com, which is kind of confusing. It's also the same website as thehighend.org. So when I did have a little dispensary in town, it was called High End. And so you can still go to thehighend.org. And read tons of articles that I've written on science around cannabis, how to use it, how to store it, how to travel with it. And you can also learn about my consultation fees and what I do.
So it's your work as a dispensary that's the past. And are you
going to
do that in the future again at some point?
Yes, I could. Essentially, if they pass, so a couple options. I could get a team together and, you know, $500,000 and submit a application for a big dispensary. It's not exactly what I'm interested in. I would work at a dispensary. It was very stressful to run a business and essentially a doctor's office out of my home. So yeah. Doing it all myself feels exhausting at this point in my life. But in the near future, if we pass recreational laws and they allow smaller operations to form, I can imagine doing that. I would love to work with a very committed team. And, you know, I'm in the Pioneer Valley. I understand the culture. I like the idea of a small local farm.
Yeah.
And so dispensaries are great. It's like Home Depots are great and Kraft food, you know, feeds a lot of people. But I do love the idea of a small local farm where you can go visit and mm-hmm. pet the cannabis plants and things
cool.
like that.
Well, thanks for your work alleviating people's pain in the valley and educating people and coming onto the show.
It was my pleasure.
It's been great to have you. I want to play a song. This is Afro Man.
Great song. Thanks, Ruthie.
Ironically, I care about everything. Problems with glaucoma, but then I got high. Smell the cannabis aroma, and I got high. Glaucoma's getting better, and I know why.
Why, man?
Yeah, cause I got high.
Baby.
Because I got high.
Yeah.
Because I got high.
La, 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 da, da.
I used to smoke cigarettes, but then I got high. Get tired and call it quits, but then I got high.
La, da, da, da.
I'm playing basketball and jogging, and I know why.
Because I got high,
yeah.
Because I got high,
la, la, da, da, da.
drink beer and wine, but then I got high. I woke up feeling fine, 'cause I got high. My hangover's over and I know why.
Why, man?
Yeah, 'cause I got high, because I got high, because I got high. Attacks, but then I got high. Ooh. I used to take Xanax, but then I got high. No more prescription pills, and I know why.
Why,
yeah, 'cause I got high, because I got high, because I got high. La, 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 da, da. The state made revenue because I got high. They built a school or two because I got high. Now the state can fund drug treatment and I know why. Yeah, 'cause I got high, because I got high, because I got high. La, 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 da, da. No more criminal traps if it's legalized. I don't have to buy from gangbangers shooting craps if it's legalized. Say what's up to the entire staff at Normal, all the secretaries, all the lawyers, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. I want to say what's up to Weed Maps. Thanks for putting me on. Y'all go get one of them Weed Map apps. Navigate to a dispensary anywhere in the world.
So that was Afro Man. Before the hour is up, I had another thing that I wanted to ask Ezra about. He had mentioned before we went on the air about people that use medical marijuana, you know, maybe not without a car, and they get stereotyped as just potheads, how that ties into like race and class and privilege a little bit. Do you want to say a little bit more about that, Ezra?
Yeah, one of the questions you asked me before we started was, and I talked about teaching in Holyoke and being around high school kids, disadvantaged high school kids with a lot of trauma, a lot of poverty, and many issues. And much of what is addressed effectively by cannabis is PTSD, anxiety, depression. And although there is a whole world of people medicating or people smoking, I will say, you know, to keep it in sort of the inner city culture and the sort of pop culture, you know, smoking blunts and smoking pot, there is a lot of abuse. Addiction to the drug is bad, but there is a huge amount of medicating occurring that's may not even be known by the high schoolers, by the kids, moms, who are suffering, anxiety attacks, PTSD. And I saw it a lot. You know, you interact with a lot of people, and as you work in the industry, you hear stories of people who could not get by, without it. I knew, someone who went to boarding school, you know, a white person whose father died when he was in his sophomore year. And he said that smoking weed, you know, down in the basement got him through that sophomore year because he was incredibly depressed about his father dying. So it is important that we have safe and regulated methods for cannabis, but also acknowledge that, and even if you're listening and you have a teenager who smokes pot a lot, what issues are they dealing with? How are they medicating? What kind of trauma can they be helped with? I've consulted with parents who worry about their kids' abuse, and we talk about that. You know, what are they dealing with, and what kind of mood or emotional issues can be helped or have been hindered by cannabis? There's a fine line.
All right. Thanks again. You've been listening to Ezra Parzivak, neighbor and medical marijuana consultant. This is Out There on Valley Free Radio. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Up at 5 o'clock.
Tune in to Off the Record every Sunday from 7 to 8 p.m. for some of the craziest comedy music from past and present. Hosted by DJ Darude.